Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 278. PyCoders Weekly included over 1,500 links to articles, blog posts, tutorials, and projects in 2025. Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week to help wrap up everything by sharing some highlights and uncovering a few hidden gems from the pile. We share the top links explored by PyCoders readers. We also dig into trends across all the articles and stories this year. We highlight a few gems that we didn't cover on the show and a couple that explore the overall themes of the year. We hope you enjoy this review. We look forward to bringing you an upcoming year full of great Python news, articles, topics, and projects. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hey there.
I should be saying Happy New Year because this is our PyCoders Weekly 2025 top articles we're going to dig into here.
Yes, and we pre-record it, so Happy New Year seems weird, but yeah. Sure, Happy New Year, Happy Valentine's Day, July 4th, let's just cover it all for now, we'll go from there.
Yeah, definitely. So we did have one little news thing that we wanted to hit on because it's kind of a big one that we've been leading up to. You want to dig into that?
Yeah, sure. As I mentioned, we pre-record this. Holiday time gets a little busy for everybody. So we're not going to do a lot of news because little bits and pieces are probably a bit dated. But Django 6 came out on December 3rd, and that's a big release. And so we figured we should highlight it. I haven't had a chance to play with it yet myself, but I'm looking forward to seeing the new stuff. The big new additions here are template partials, background tasks, and a modernization of the email tools. Along with Django 6, Django 5.1 has gone end of life. As usual with Django, their .2 versions are their LTSs, so the .2 will be around for a while.
Yeah. Well, we are here to discuss PyCoders generally, and the newsletter had an interesting 2025. We'll dive into the details, but one of the things we like to share is what bubbled to the top and what were the most views or clicks from the newsletter and from the website. We collect that information, and so these are the top five. I'm going to kind of go through them here. The number one piece is from Jacob Padilla, and it's titled The Inner Workings of Python Data Classes Explained. I know that we are both big fans of data classes, and they come up on the show many times. In fact, it goes back to many conversations I had with Gare Arna over the years, and he's definitely used them across his tutorials and has a great resource on Real Python. And this one is a really good guide. It's about discovering how to use Python data classes and how they work internally, and you get to learn about using the Dunder annotations and exec methods, and then how to make your own data class decorator. So it's a neat little deep dive, and definitely can see why it was popular. Number two is a podcast episode. It's episode 249 that I had with Brett Cannon, and this was back in April. My description of it is, what's the best way to record Python dependencies for the reproducibility of your projects? And the title of the show was Going Beyond Requirements.txt with PyLock.toml at PEP751. Brett had been, well, he shares a lot of the saga of pushing PEP751 forward and the multiple attempts to try to figure out how to do lock files and how to get the requirements.txt to be a much more robust solution by combining it into this new format. And the PEP was approved. And so it was kind of fun to sort of celebrate that with him. And I feel like the standards actually gathered some traction across the summer and the fall. I keep hearing little words about different projects using it. UV was one of the ones that was a little up in the air at the time of the episode, but they definitely have. And that is related to a recent development with FastAPI, which will maybe come up again in the show here. They're going to be using PyLock.toml for its FastAPI cloud platform, which actually uses UV as part of the tooling there. Number three is a Django versus FastAPI, an honest comparison. So this one is from David DeHaan on his blog, and it's actually a much deeper comparison than I thought it would be. Lots of personal experience is shared across the areas of contrast. Our summary was David's worked with Django for a long time, but recently has done some deeper coding with FastAPI. And as a result, he's been able to provide a good contrast between the libraries and why and when you might choose one over the other. And I totally agree with that summary. It does a really good job of going into his personal experience using these things and the different places where one may make sense for another. And so it's a good, honest comparison. There's a lot of advice also. Number four is a real Python one. This is written by Abdelhadi Daiuri, and this came out in May. It's titled How to Use Logaru for Simpler Python Logging. There's been a lot of talk about logging this year, I think mainly due to T-strings coming out in 3.14. And I won't go into that because there are plenty of mentions across our episodes and real Python tutorials. In this tutorial, you learn about using Logaru, and I'm guessing that's how you pronounce it, or Logaru, to quickly implement better logging in your Python applications, and you get to spend less time wrestling with the configurations. I think that's probably the big thing for somebody coming into it, is there's a lot of choices in creating a logger, and this actually answers a lot of them by having pre-configured stuff ready to go for you, and you can actually spend more time sort of figuring out what your logs are presenting you and using them effectively to debug issues. And then the fifth one is actually from the CodeCut site. And I had Quinn Tran on recently to talk about, you know, not only her site, but a book she did about data science, which was a great conversation. And we actually talked about Marco Gorelli, who is the creator of Narwhals. Well, this is a guest post on her site, and it's titled Narwhals Unified Data Frame Functions for Pandas, Polars, and PySpark. He came on the site to write up a detailed explanation of what the concept of Narwhals is and how it's a compatibility layer between these data frame libraries. Marco's been on the show and we discussed Narwhals quite a bit. Fun to talk to him about the concepts. In this article, he gets into how pandas, the sort of this lingua franca of all these different data frame libraries, everybody kind of like defaulted to it, but why maybe using something like this would actually be a much more efficient way to do things. And he's been working inside all of these data frame libraries quite a bit. So again, if your code is touching pandas, polars, or DuckDB, PySpark, or PyArrow, he's been working with all of them and along with that data frame libraries and working on interconnecting them. So if you're interested in learning a little bit more about making these tools function together and maybe ways to make your data frame usage a little more quick and useful, something to check out. So that was the top five. We wanted to talk a little bit about general stuff across there. One of the things that is the top 10 is, I think, Marco Gorelli's Twitter feed, which I think was kind of an interesting one that popped up. And then the quiz for the article on Logaru. And then I think just under like 21 was my Michael Kennedy podcast, where we talked about containerizing Python applications and generating static sites and stuff like that. Those are a couple of things I mentioned, and I'll chime back in. But you had some things that you discovered as you were digging through this list of articles.
Yeah, I just sort of went looking for patterns, and there were three or four that showed up in the list, like you mentioned, that were sort of duplicates. So like we had the Narwhals article, and we had Marco's Twitter feed. For data purposes, I counted those as one. So
yeah,
this is actually from the top 104 because of those duplicates being removed. But just some patterns, the most common topics, and this is a very large bucket, so that's probably why it's a big number, but was like just articles on general Python core language, standard library stuff, you know, data classes, concurrency, dunder and nit, doc strings, REPLs, all that kind of good stuff. There were 27 of the first top 104 were that. Not surprisingly, the next highest mention was Python 3.14, the Py release. Yeah. There were 15 of those. There were three or four that were sort of general articles. Then, you know, a bunch of stuff on T-strings, subinterpreters, free-threaded, the JITs, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, much of our coverage from Real Python was in there.
Bunch of the Real Python stuff is there, yep. closely followed behind that, and again, this is a fairly big bucket, but is like package management and tooling. So things like the podcast episode where you were talking to Brett, requirements files, the release of the TIE linter, general infrastructure, PI Project TOML, all the rest of that kind of stuff. So there were 14 of the top 104 were that. Next down was web things. So Django, FastAPI, Streamlit, there were 8 of those. Oh, I mucked up my order. I'm bad at sorting. Oh, that's bad. Anyways, data science-y stuff, that was actually a little above the web pieces. That was number 10. There were 10 of these. So there was Narwhal's mentions, NumPy, DuckDB had a fair amount of content, some Polar stuff, some notebook stuff, that kind of thing. And then, interestingly, 8 of them were like general programming, sometimes Python as the examples and sometimes just general programming things. So things like design patterns, feature flags, big O notation. So considering it's a Python newsletter, we do seem to at least attract folks who are interested in just the general programming stuff as well. This was a three-way tie. So there was the general programming bucket, then there was the community bucket, things like DjangoCon, the documentary came out this year, yeah. Or last year. Happy New Year. I'll get it straight eventually. Yeah. The PSF fund drive, those kinds of things. And then the three-way tie goes to just sort of general articles on projects and libraries. So a little bit of that lazy import stuff, GUIs, TUIs, writing with GPUs, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then the last few were, there were a handful of things on testing, a handful of things on LLM. That probably more than anything else reveals my bias as the editor, because I don't link to that stuff a lot. If you're interested in it, go to a LLM newsletter is my attitude. I try not to push too much of that stuff in. And then there were some odds and ends there as on logging as well. For very, very specific mentionings, DuckDB and T-Strings both had 3 full articles on them, so getting them out of those buckets. And there were 5 different articles on typing.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
That's kind of interesting because, again, with my bias, you'd think it would be less than that. But there were a couple different PEPs that came out in 2025 that were around that space. And so that would have been probably why there was some traffic in that area.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I looked through it, the growth of type checking and then across like sort of very specific tasks that you can do with it, which I think is where it fits, you know. I wanted to mention the continued growth of Marimo across the year. You mentioned already Ty, but the other tools from Astral of UV and Ruff got mentioned quite a bit also. And then, yeah, the one I was surprised by that I guess I wasn't expecting was all the GUI frameworks kind of popping out this year.
Yes.
But they're kind of connected to web libraries. We've mentioned, you know, Nice Guy and a couple other ones that are there. But it's nice in a way that you don't have to learn JavaScript and you're mainly using Python there. So a lot of, I don't know, unexpected growth in that area. So we wanted to cover a few that we didn't get to across all the different PyCoders episodes of the podcast, a couple of sort of hidden gems. I have a pair, and then I think you have one, and then we'll kind of maybe cover a couple other sort of other ones that we want to honorably mention. So you ready to dig into these?
Let's go.
All right. So what's your first one here?
I've got, this was article number 38 on our most clicked list, and it's a topic we haven't really talked about that much this year. Its title is Data Validation Libraries for Polars, and it's by Rich Ione. When you say data validation to a Python programmer, the usual answer is Pydantic, which if you're grabbing things in from disk or an API or you need to handle user input, users, they're tricky. You know, Pydantic's probably the right answer. So I even learned recently that it also supports configuration structures from files and environment variables. So Pydantic, yay, useful tool. But when you're in data frame land, Pydantic doesn't really help you. And when you are in data frame land, clean data is paramount. You see, most data is like a river where the town upstream is using it for waste disposal. Okay, I'll stop with the geography analogies.
Nice.
But there is a saying in computing, garbage in, garbage out. And of course, this is a big part of what data scientists do is deal with this in the cleaning. When you load data into Polars, it automatically does some type safety checking, but it's just a first step. And just because something is of the right type doesn't mean it's valid. your temperature could be a valid float, but that doesn't mean you're allowed to have values below absolute zero, as an example. So what Rich's article does is summarize five different validation libraries that work with polars. They are Pandera, Petito, Point Blank, Valid Oopsie, that's just fun, and Data Framely. Each of these have strengths and weaknesses, and in fact, that's kind of the purpose of the article. To show off the capabilities of these libraries, Rich starts out with a simple Polars data frame containing some people data. It's just a handful of rows, but you've got a column for an ID, a column for age, a column for email addresses, and a score. And then he specifies valid ranges and patterns, like regexes for the email for these. He seems to think 80 is the top age range, and he's 95 is invalid. I think Rich needs to hang out with some older people, because that's not quite dead yet, but that's just a quibble. With the data in hand, he starts out by using Pandera to validate the contents of the data frame. Pandera uses a data frame schema object, which looks an awful lot like a regular Polars data frame, and it uses things like Polars types along with validators called checks. So for example, there's a less than and a greater than check, and that ensures that a column is within a certain range. Once you've defined your schema, you call its validate method, passing in your actual data frame, and it throws exceptions if things don't pass. So that's kind of the purpose of it. That's what drives it. The next library that Rich covers is Petito, which takes a pedantic-style approach. So instead of defining a column-based schema, you define a model class that looks like pedantic or a data class. You use type hints and annotations to specify the types and ranges. And then, like before, you call validate, and that's how you get it. Next up is Point Blank, which is inspired by an R library of the same name. This uses a column-based approach similar to Pandera, but it separates the column definitions from the verification part. So you specify the column schemas, but then you use Polars-like queries for the validation instead. The end result is the code's a little messier, but the output is beautiful. It generates an interactive report that non-technical users can read to see the state of the data. So it flags problems as being warnings, errors, or critical, and outputs a nice table that summarizes how everything went. If you're building something where your users are uploading a CSV, this is the kind of tool that's great, as it helps them visualize where their data is dirty so they can then fix it and resubmit. So that's kind of a handy different thing, and it's a worthy trade-off from the messier code. The fourth library, my new favorite library name, Valid Oopsie, it's just fun to say, it takes yet another approach. Here you define validation classes, which you can then chain together into a series of rules. The advantage of this one is the classes are reusable. So if you've got multiple projects which are using the same kinds of data restrictions, then you can create little reusable validation utilities so you're not having to repeat yourself. Then the last library that Rich covers is Data Framely. This one is similar to Petito in that it uses a pedantic-like class, but it has a very powerful rule mechanism, which is done through class methods, and it gives you a lot of flexibility over and above just the base annotation stuff. I've really only skimmed the surface. Rich's article does a fairly deep dive on every one of these libraries, and for each, he talks about its strengths and weaknesses, as well as how they compare against each other. So if you're using Polars for your data science-y needs, you should definitely read this to better understand all the data validation choices that are out there.
Yeah, I've always been intrigued by these libraries, so it's kind of cool to see this collection getting reviewed here, so that's great.
Similar to that, I actually did a guest spot on Talk Python back in June of 2025 on a very similar topic. It was episode number 510, and it was 10 Polars tools and techniques to level up your data science. We talked about some of these validation libraries as well as other things out there that could be helpful. So that might be worth checking out if you like as well.
Awesome. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. Python is an extremely flexible language, and within it, you can follow many paradigms. Functional programming is a programming paradigm in which the primary method of computation is the evaluation of functions. But how does Python implement functional programming? Well, this course is titled Using Functional Programming in Python. It's based on a RealPython tutorial by John Stearns. And the video course is presented by my frequent co-host, Christopher Trudeau. And in it, you'll learn what the functional programming paradigm entails, what it means to say that functions are first-class citizens in Python, how to define anonymous functions with the Lambda keyword, and how to implement functional code using map, filter, and reduce. Soon, you'll be mapping values across iterables, filtering through lists, tuples, and dictionaries, or using reduce to calculate across an iterable into a final value. Like most of the video courses on Real Python, the course is broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, you get code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. I have a pair of articles, and these are from previous guest Adam Johnson. He's been on the show to discuss boosting your Django DX, the developer experience, if you will, and boosting your Git DX, among other things. I've been trying to get him on the show to discuss his new book. He has done a new book. It's called Boost Your GitHub DX. So it's kind of more about getting the most out of using GitHub and all the different services that GitHub provides, everything from, of course, repositories that you know, but, you know, using GitHub Actions for, you know, CI/CD type of stuff, continuous integration, and the static pages that you can create in there too. So it's a very thorough thing. If you've seen any of his books or read some of his stuff from his blog, you know he's a very thorough author. And so I really enjoy that. And number 8 in our list is titled Python. I think that's his way of just sort of describing if it's like something for, you know, generally Python or Django or whatever. This one is create temporary files and directories in unit tests. So that's one of the other things he's very interested in is testing and how to kind of make that easier for a lot of people. And so this first one digs into how your tests that you create might require that you have temporary files or temporary directories. And so he shares the details on using the standard library tempfile module, and he builds up a set of recipes for creating it for individual tests. And then if you need temporary files across your whole test suite, how to make them using setup. And at the end of the piece, he also dives into how to use Pathlib to simplify the whole process. It's really kind of a back and forth with a lot of code examples, which I think is going to help you get into this if you, again, are working in testing and you need to have your project dealing with files and temporary files. The other one I wanted to cover is number 87 in our list, and it is capture standard out, spelled STDOUT, and standard error, spelled STDERR, in unit test. So when you're testing your code, the outputs from the terminal, either through standard out or standard error, you may want to capture that output and make assertions on it. And so this piece digs into that. He covers using the context lib.redirect_standard_out and the redirect_standard_error to do this. He is a fan of using the built-in libraries as much as possible, you know, not having to go to third-party things to learn and how to use these things. And so he gets into, you know, simplifying capturing streams, asserting on the different log messages. He also talks a little bit about why you would want to avoid using the tools that come in test.support. The test support module is an internal part of Python's own test suite. There's no guarantees of stability or backwards compatibility there. So he's, again, kind of referring you to the standard library and using tools inside there. So again, if you're working with either standard out stuff that you're printing to the terminal, or if there are errors coming out and you want to be able to kind of make assertions and work upon it inside your tests. So a couple ways to kind of boost your unit test skills here from Adam Johnson.
And let's just keep making this about me while we're at it. I actually support a open source library called Waelstow, W-A-E-L-S-T-O-W, that actually has helper methods for both of these problems. There's context managers for capturing standard error and standard out in testing. And there's a context manager for temporarily moving a directory so that your tests can use like the same directory names that your production code would, but it wouldn't accidentally wipe something out. I'm looking at the documentation of it right now, and I need to update the Knox file. So, because it isn't testing on 3.14 yet, but it's out there.
Okay.
So if this is in your wheelhouse, someone else may have written some code that's helpful to you already.
Nice. All right. Yeah. So we'll include a link for that there. We had a couple other ones we wanted to mention, sort of an honorable mention from people that do top 10 lists or whatever. And the first one, digging into a little bit of the data science stuff there.
Yeah. So this is number 9 and number 12 on our most clicked list. They're actually sort of pointed to the same content. Number 9 is an article titled, "I Don't Like NumPy," by a blogger who goes by the name Dynomite, spelled M-I-G-H-T. And number 12 was the Associated Hacker News discussion on this article. If you missed it, the article caused a bit of a fuss on the internet when it came out in May, and it made the discussion boards kind of busy. And in fact, there were a few talkback articles as well, so there was a bit of chatter around it for a while. I would have liked to cover this article in more depth, but it really isn't podcast friendly, nor for the faint of heart. Dynomite goes deep into different uses of NumPy and why they think it overcomplicates things that should be simpler. If you're into multidimensional arrays and linear algebra solvers and you're not afraid of a strong opinion, it's an interesting read. It's long enough that there's an intermission in it.
Yeah.
Part of their thesis is that because lots of libraries are inspired by or built on top of NumPy, many of NumPy's, I'll use the word, bad choices have reverberated through our community. So to be clear, it's a well-thought-out article. It isn't rage bait by any means, but strong opinions tend to invoke strong reactions. Whether or not you agree, it's definitely an interesting point of view, and I understand why it hit our top 10.
Yeah. Not for the faint of heart. All right, so the next one I have is sort of a review of and a summarization of a conference talk from EuroPython 2025. And it's the pieces by Jake Edge on lwn.net. Jake does this from time to time. He'll go to some of these conferences and then take down like a lot of notes about what happened, or maybe he's rewatching the video. I'm not sure his process, but this one is titled "Python Performance Myths and Fairy Tales." And it summarizes a talk by Antonio Cuni, spelled C-U-N-I. He is a longtime contributor to PyPy, which is always very confusing in our industry. That's P-Y-P-Y. It's an alternative Python interpreter. His talk spoke about the challenges and limits of performance in Python and how the flexibility of dynamic languages comes at a cost. And so we've discussed that a lot. And then there's also an associated Hacker News discussion that I'll have the link for also. And really, what at the end of the day, it's one of these things about the performance myths. He actually had two different audiences raise their hands if they thought that Python was slow. And it kind of depended where in the world you were, which I thought was interesting, how many hands were raised. And I think that might go to just the way people talk about Python, maybe more in the data science realm. It's not thought of that. Whereas maybe people in the US have a different opinion, or it's just, again, it was sort of interesting to see. There's a lot of talk about how people think that Python isn't slow because it's, you know, only the GPU that matters and Python's simply this glue code. And he wants to contrast that. There's a lot of concepts in it that have to do with bottlenecks or areas where there are problems with it. And I think some of the biggest problems that I have seen and talked to people about kind of go back to this idea of profiling, which is something I think is going to be covered a lot more over the next year. They're building.
Oh, yeah. It's coming. Oh, yeah.
The profiler tools that are going to be built in the next version of Python look really fascinating. We'll have some pieces coming on Real Python about it. So, yeah. Anyway, it has to do a lot with RAM and the idea of like pushing and pulling these large data sets in and out of that. And that's kind of where a lot of this stuff slowdown happens. It's why we like things like pullers. We talk about lazy evaluation and being more efficient on like how you address stuff and not, you know, applying things across an entire data set when it only is should be across a certain set of columns and rows or what have you. So anyway, it's a very interesting piece. Involves a few different sort of code examples in it. And he's actually working on his own language, which I think is interesting, called SPy. And I'll include a GitHub link for that also, so you can learn a little bit more about it. But yeah, it's a fascinating piece. And I definitely would check out the talk if you're interested in digging into the controversy of, performance and speed and the fairy tales.
It's kind of funny when you think about it, like, you know, we use Python as both a dune buggy and an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
And so what does fast mean? Right? Like,
yeah. And sometimes there's like a little scooter or whatever, you know, just to get from point to point.
Yeah. So, and then what, you know, it almost always comes up against like, well, except for this other language. And it's like, well, but that other language can only be used as a scooter. So yeah they're better at scooters. No wonder. Right. So like, it's a weird thing. Right.
Yeah.
We posted something recently in PyCoders, which was, it was a very generic article. It wasn't Python specific, but it was sort of just this concept of what is fast and slow even mean?
Right.
Like, there really isn't any other industry where you're dealing with optimizing both nanoseconds and hours or days, because sometimes you're in trying to optimize a loop, and sometimes you've got, you know, something that takes days to run, and if you can turn, you know, the 3-day runtime into a day and a half, all of a sudden you're the rock star.
Yeah.
Even within the scale of programming, the concept of fast and slow is very unethereal.
Well, yeah, I'd love to dig into trends that we think we're going to see across 2026, but I think maybe we'll leave that for another show. It's going to be an interesting year. This definitely was 2025 was a slog. So congratulations, everyone, making it through the year. And
that's a presumptuous thing to say when we record before the end of the year.
Hey, if they're listening to the show, they made it through the year. I'm doing simple math here. All right. Well, Chris, it's been fantastic to talk to you across 2025, and I look forward to speaking to you across 2026.
Yep. It's going to be fun.
All right. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.